ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
Leader Liz Foslane was dealing with a big moment in her life, but she couldn't tell her team what was happening.
Yeah, it was very hard. And one of the reasons it took me so long was that I couldn't talk about it without getting choked up.
And she tried communicating it through actions, like moving meetings.
But it did get to the point where, because I hadn't explained why I was moving so many meetings, someone on my team flagged to me that the team was very anxious because they were worried that, you know, there was a lot of uncertainty at the time, that they were going to get laid off, or they just didn't know what was happening. So it got to the point where I had to explain.
And what she ended up sharing with them was personal and had nothing to do with them or their jobs, but it did have an effect on Liz at work.
And what I ended up doing was just during a team meeting saying, hey, you've probably noticed my schedule has changed. My father-in-law is in his sort of final stages of battling cancer. That's what's been happening. And I honestly can't talk about it. It's still too painful. And so the best way to support me is just to, you know, be there. But it's not something that I feel comfortable going into in a lot of detail.
Simple yet effective, but still so hard to do. Hello. I'm Lisa Leong, and in this third instalment of our series about your health at work, we're digging deep and talking about emotions.
Our emotions are data. They contain valuable information.
Why it's good for you to talk about your feelings at work and how to get that balance right.
Bringing emotion into the workplace does not mean you become a feelings fire hose where you say every single thing that's on your mind.
And we'll hear what happens when we don't express ourselves at work.
In teaching, it's like, well, if you're having some trouble, just suck it up, princess. Having to mask that you're coping in front of colleagues, in front of your leaders as well, that becomes incredibly onerous. And there's a very strong link between emotional exhaustion and burnout and emotional labour.
Let's return now to Liz Foslane and what happened after she told her team about her father-in-law passing away.
People responded in such a lovely way, and I think it emphasized to me, one, that you need to be transparent as a leader, especially because people will read into your actions far more than you think they will, but also that being transparent doesn't mean that you need to go into every detail. You can still hold firm boundaries and communicate why you're holding those, and people were very respectful, and I couldn't have asked for better support from them.
To tell you what Liz does is to say she has many strings to her bow.
I'm the co-author and illustrator of two best-selling books on emotions at work, and I lead storytelling for Team Anywhere at Atlassian, which is kind of our future of work department.
And that idea of having some sort of boundaries and not letting it just kind of all pour out, why do you think we need to make that distinction?
People have different comfort levels. I think that's one, is that, you know, I speak to so many people about emotions at work. And one of the things people will often say is, I bought in that I'm an emotional creature, that we can't all be robots in the workplace. But I also am just not naturally someone who shares a lot, or I'm not that emotionally expressive. Do I need a personality transplant? And the answer is absolutely not. Like, you should be authentic to who you are and what feels comfortable to you. I think that's one. And then the other is, if you're a leader, there is actually a delicate balance between sharing and being open and having a human connection, giving people visibility into what's going on with you and at the organization, and overburdening them. So, for example, if there's something really challenging, it's useful for your team to know that, and you can speak to how it's affecting you. I'm stressed too. But your job as a leader is to create stability. And part of that is leading people through the challenge, showing them that you have a plan. So when I said I had to go out on bereavement leave, I had a plan for who they would report to during that time. And it's actually not useful to your team if you start sobbing and say, this is so challenging, I'm never going to get through it. You know, I don't know what's going to happen to all of you. Don't ask me any questions. You know, even if that is your mental state, your role as a manager is to do a little extra work so that people have that human connection with you, but also don't feel like they've just been cast off into this unknown, uncertain, dark pit. So I think there's multiple reasons why it's important.
I wonder whether most of us do the opposite of that. In a way, we shut down. We don't bring our emotions at work because we've learnt that to be professional, in quotation marks, means to not show our emotions. Can we be professional and emotional?
Absolutely. And I think a lot of research shows, especially over the past 10 years, the leader that people want to follow is more emotional than just completely closed off. And I think the reason that we are worried about expressing feelings or emotions in the workplace is that we never received good guidance on how to do that in an effective way. So again, showing up to your team and saying, our goals have shifted. I know you've done a lot of work. I know this is stressful. All change is stressful. I'm feeling it too. But here's what we're going to do to make sure that our efforts don't go to waste. Here's how we're going to plan for these new goals. I think that's a much better way to show up as a leader than just to say, our goals have shifted, get on board. You know, people feel worse if you don't acknowledge the emotions that go along with something. But that's also still a delicate balance, right? I didn't say our goals have shifted. What are we going to do? Oh my gosh, guys, like this is the worst thing ever. You should all look for new jobs. That's also not a great way of expressing emotions. So I always say, like, bringing emotion into the workplace does not mean you become a feelings fire hose where you say every single thing that's on your mind.
Feelings fire hose. I love that. So Liz, where then is this line between sharing and oversharing?
It's hard. It's hard to figure out. I think it depends on the context. So it depends on the organization you work in. It depends on your role. So manager versus individual contributor versus CEO. And it also depends on your relationship with the people. So if, for example, you're managing a team and you have four people on your team and you've all known each other for 5 years, oversharing will look different than if you're in a very traditional white glove organization where you're new to the leadership role and you maybe want to be a little more closed off than you might be in other environments. So I know that's not like a nice, here's the punchy one-two answer, but I do think a lot of this is feeling out the emotional culture of a place. And then also asking yourself, if the roles were reversed, what would be useful for me to know and what might feel like too much?
Liz calls this selective vulnerabilities.
Opening up, sharing, acknowledging emotions, acknowledging what you're feeling. And it's fine to be open about that. You're allowed to have bad days, but it's not opening up so much so that you are actually, again, burdening people on the other side. And so some of that just comes down to flagging your feelings without being emotionally leaky. So one thing too is if you have a bad day, if you don't acknowledge that to your team, they probably can tell and they will assume that it's because they did something wrong. That's just how we act as humans. And so as a leader, like I have said as a leader, it's 4 p.m. in the afternoon. I've had back-to-back meetings. I'm just exhausted. It has nothing to do with you. I want to be present. Give me a moment. I want to be here. I want to be intentional about how I'm showing up for you. Just flagging, it's been a long day. And so I think that builds that human connection. I didn't go into any details. I didn't overshare about the meeting that just happened. That was a nightmare, you know, but I'm still flagging for that person. If I seem a little off, you don't need to be anxious about it. It's because of outside forces that have not, it's not because of your performance or because you need to be worried about your job.
So Liz, how can we get a different perspective on an emotional state, especially if we're anxious about something at work?
So often problems feel far greater than they actually are, especially in the heat of the moment. I will say for myself, I am what's called a catastrophizer, which is I will always think of the absolute worst thing that could happen. And it was interesting when I was speaking with people about uncertainty, a lot of people gave me the advice or said what worked for them was asking, you know, what's the worst thing that can happen? And then they would realize that it wasn't that bad. And my response was the worst thing that can happen that I can come up with is really bad. So that's not a useful question for me because I can go dark fast. And so what I've learned now is what's the best thing that could happen? What's the most likely thing that will happen? And again, I just can't emphasize enough sleeping on it, right? I think the problem always seems a lot greater at night when you haven't slept, when it's been a long day. And so there's usually nothing that needs to be attended to immediately. So taking that time to get yourself in a better mental state, ask, you know, I think especially with virtual communication, we can often misread someone's words and we read into them and then come up with this horrible scenario that's not true. So just kind of trying to, especially if you know you have a tendency for that, asking yourself alternate questions or coming with an open mind to the situation rather than assuming the worst.
So I can think of a few examples where I felt emotional at work. Hi, my name's Alana, and I currently work in mental health policy. I think most recently it was last week where I was crying at my desk, kind of reflecting on things that have happened personally. And I felt vulnerable in that particular situation, but also felt comfortable enough in a way to do that, because I guess at our work, in particular in my space, we have this kind of concept about bringing your whole self to work and making sure that the culture and the leadership that create that culture really create a supportive environment where you feel safe to share, you know, personal stories about your own experience, because that kind of contributes to, I guess, improving policy and improving the mental health system in our work. I think, yeah, often it's not very clear about how much you should share to benefit the work, but also how much you shouldn't share, you know, with fear of impacting and harming others.
Liz, what is your view on crying at work? In the past, it might have been viewed as a career killer.
You know, research shows that most people have cried at work or cried about work. So I don't think crying is a career killer. I think that your response to it can have implications. There was also research done, and men, people who identify as men, tend to perceive crying as a form of sadness in the workplace. But when the researchers asked women, women overwhelmingly said, I don't cry because I'm sad. I cry because I'm frustrated and no one is listening to me.
Interesting.
Yeah, totally interesting. And also shows how the same expression can be interpreted very differently. Like, we can misinterpret what someone's intentions are, what they mean.
Mm.
So I would say it's very normal to cry at work. Some research shows that if you frame that as I'm crying because I'm passionate, like I just care so much about the work, it's perceived much better in the workplace. But I also think if you just take a moment to collect yourself or say, like, I just need to excuse myself, and then you come back, whether it's later that day or the next day, and say, hey, I had a strong reaction in our meeting. I wanted to talk through with you why, so that, you know, we can get to a better resolution. I think that's actually very admirable. We all have emotional moments. And so I think people will generally look upon it much more favorably if you're able to then show that you did the work to collect yourself, to understand what you need, and to advocate for yourself, and also help that person understand how to support you.
If you're a manager or a leader and one of your team members cries in a meeting in front of you, what should you do?
Great question. I think always giving them space. So it's, again, usually you're not going to have the most productive conversation if you force someone to talk through their tears. So I've cried at work, and I've had a manager say, like, hey, why don't you go camera off, mute yourself, message me when you're ready to come back on. But I do think as a manager, then it's following up and saying, hey, you know, I noticed that you had the strong reaction, and I really want to understand where that was coming from, because it's an indication that something happened. And as a manager, my role is to support you and to figure out what we can do about it. So I think it's, don't put them on the spot, give them space to process what's going on, but then do in a gentle way. And it can be a day later, follow up to see what happened. And, you know, often there's really valuable information in that for you as a manager.
Working in that environment for a number of years, I felt like a sponge that had been wrung out emotionally, that I just had no more to give. I had no more care. I had no more concern for these young people. I felt very detached. My jug was just empty and I had nothing left to give.
That's Dr. Saul Karnofsky, Senior Lecturer in Education at Curtin University. And that experience of feeling like a wrung-out sponge was from when he was a high school teacher.
And the work that I was doing at that school was incredibly emotionally demanding. And that was generally because the young people that I was working with were coming to school with a variety of issues and traumas.
And he realised that teachers aren't taught how to prepare for the emotional demands of their work.
Absolutely not. And that was the reason why I decided to pursue a PhD in this space, in trying to understand, better grapple with this, what I felt was a deficit in myself. Like, why didn't I have enough? Why couldn't I give enough? Was it something to do with me, or was it something to do with the profession and the kinds of assumptions and norms we put upon teachers around this emotional work that increasingly teachers are having to do day in, day out? And it's more acute and demanding in some communities. But, you know, across the spectrum, if you like, teachers are feeling, certainly here in Australia, emotionally exhausted and under stress and strain in a number of dimensions with regard to their emotional resources. And this is part of the reason why many teachers are throwing their hands up and saying, I haven't got anything left to give, much like I did, and are walking away from a job that they love and certainly got into because they wanted to make a meaningful difference in the lives of young people.
So Saul tracked 100 students doing a Diploma of Education in Western Australia. He wanted to understand the emotional dimension when it came to becoming a teacher.
So a good example is, here in Australia, we often say that a teacher should never cry in front of students. Frustration, in anger, in fear and anxiety, there are lots of reasons why a teacher might express that very vulnerable, very human emotion in front of students. Sometimes grief, depression, look, there's a whole list of different reasons. But I was really curious about why we say that teachers should or shouldn't do certain things emotionally, either with students, with parents and carers, or with their colleagues. And very quickly, I discovered that there are a very set and prescribed set of emotional rules for teachers. And this can often make it quite difficult for people to work out, you know, because they're unspoken largely, to work out what is appropriate and what isn't appropriate. And if a teacher and somebody learning to become a teacher feels a sense of anxiety, fear, hopelessness, worry, stress, they're really unsure about where it's safe to express those kinds of emotions. They often, one of the participants in my study was feeling a range of very difficult emotions, particularly anxiety and being overwhelmed. And so she ran to the toilets and sort of cried her eyes out in the toilets and didn't want to express that emotion, particularly in front of her supervising or mentor teacher. She said that it was because she was worried that her mentor teacher would think that she wasn't right or fit for the job, not being able to cope, and therefore the person thinks that maybe the teaching profession isn't for me. And I think there's some problems in there because it speaks to a wider culture in teaching. In teaching, it's like, well, if you're having some trouble, just suck it up, princess, is a sort of well-heeled statement that certainly got told to me.
So you mentioned that the unwritten convention of putting on a stoic exterior, quote unquote, suck it up, princess. So in your findings for the research that you did, what actually happens when we don't share our emotions at work?
Yeah, so this is tied to a really well-researched concept that cuts across a lot of professions but is particularly pronounced in the teaching profession. It's called emotional labour. And now it's becoming a much talked about idea or concept. And it doesn't just describe, oh, the emotions that I have to go through at work. That's sort of the surface understanding of it. It's a little bit more nuanced than that. What it actually describes is the actual work that we have to put in to manage, buffer, modify, or face act or show emotions that counterpose what we're really feeling inside. When emotional labour becomes particularly acute, though, I feel, and my research as well shows, is when you have to modify and buffer your emotions to show that you're coping in front of colleagues and show them that you're coping and that you're not suffering in some way and not weak in some way. When you're constantly having to mask that you're coping in front of colleagues, in front of your leaders as well, the principal and the leadership team, that becomes incredibly onerous. And there's a very strong link between emotional exhaustion and burnout and emotional labor. So again, it has a cumulative effect. So when, you know, this happens occasionally, it doesn't have any detrimental results for somebody in their job. But when you're doing this day in, day out, you're engaging emotional labor in front of the students every day when you're in front of them, you're engaging emotional labor in front of your colleagues, when you meet with your principal maybe to do some professional management around your career progression, et cetera, and you're saying, no, everything's fine, I'm coping, it's all good, I'm managing it all fine, but you're going home and you're falling in a great big heap and finding it difficult to get up in the morning and go to school because of that emotional demand that you're placing on yourself to show that you're coping and police those vulnerable emotions. This leads to people saying, I have to stop now, I can't do this anymore. You know, in terms of teachers' mental health, you know, 52% of our teachers are experiencing moderate to extreme depression compared to 12% in the general population. 46% are experiencing moderate to extreme anxiety compared to 9% in the general population. And finally, 60% of our teachers are experiencing moderate to extreme stress compared to only 11% in the general population. So this stuff has really real effects in the teaching profession that are quite pronounced at the moment in our country.
And finally, Liz, what are some good questions we can ask ourselves before sharing our emotions at work?
Yeah, one I would say is, how would I feel if someone shared this with me? How would I want someone to share this with me? Another is, does this need to be addressed right now? Often the answer is no. And so then you can take some more time to think about what you would like to say. And then I think another one is, what assumptions have I made? And are those true, or have I tested those? So I always say, your feelings aren't facts. Your emotions are absolutely valid. What you feel is what you're feeling, but it's often based on a conclusion that you jumped to versus actually taking the time to explore and be curious. And maybe someone meant something completely different, especially if you work on a global team. There are very different norms around communication and how much emotion to express. People might not, you know, English might not be their first language. So I think it's just useful to at least start from a place of curiosity versus leaning right away into your reaction.
And Liz, this is part of a series we're doing about health at work. Why would you say that being more vulnerable at work is helpful when it comes to our health and well-being?
The biggest is that people can't support you if you don't let them know how they can support you or that you need support. And to go back to the earliest story that I shared about when my father-in-law died, I felt such a sense of relief when I shared that because people were incredibly understanding. And I hear so much this refrain of, once I shared, I couldn't believe the response that I got and how many people had gone through something similar. So I think a big part of it is being a little more open also allows people to step up and be there for you.
Thanks to my guests, Liz Foslane, expert on emotions at work and author of No Hard Feelings and Big Feelings, Dr. Saul Karnofsky, senior lecturer in education at Curtin University, and thanks to Alana for sharing her story. I'm Lisa Leong. Thanks for listening to This Working Life. It's produced by Zoe Ferguson and mixed by Marcus Hobbs. In the next instalment of our series on your health at work, you'll get the best tips and tricks to help improve your health so you can feel your best at work.
So the hijackers are those four psychological barriers that are getting in the way. They are motivational, relational, environmental, and cognitive. And each of those particular barriers has different, what I call, habit heroes associated with it that are all behaviour change strategies where there's a ton of scientific evidence to suggest that this is going to be the best strategy to pair with your barrier.
And I nap at work. I'm known as a sort of gold medalist napper. And if people come into the ABC office and they don't know about this and they see me almost dead sitting in my chair, they don't know what's going on. They get a bit disturbed. But essentially, what you want to do is have a nap that's no longer than about 15 minutes or so. And if you have a nap that's 15 minutes or under, you wake actually quite refreshed. And it lasts another 2 or 3 hours.
Don't miss out. Hear This Working Life anytime on the ABC Listen app. Don't forget to hit the heart button so you don't miss the latest episodes. This episode was produced on the lands of the Gadigal people of the Eora Nation and the Wurundjeri people of the Kulin Nation. Until next time, work it, baby.
You've been listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.